WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
A little bit more about Barbara Garson. During the Vietnam War, she organized GI coffee houses and did some work in a collaborative work, FTA, a show made popular by Joan Fonda and Donald Sutherland, among others. She's also known for her satirical satire on state power during the Vietnam War called McBird, and she's a regular contributor to the Village Voice, Ms., and In These Times, and also recently in the July issue of Mother Jones. If you'd like to hear Barbara Garson speak tonight at the Wooden Shoe at the Community Education Center at 3500 Lancaster Avenue, here's a phone number. It's 569-2477. Well, after that, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
How did you choose what to where to visit when you were going around
writing stories for All the Livelong Day? Well, mostly I picked places that dramatically illustrated the same things that happened other places. I mean, you can see ping pong. I mean, there's a lot of jokes you can make about ping pong, but it's the same as other light industry.
Yeah, I guess to get through the day, they'd say, make a racket, ladies.
Well,
have a ball.
Yeah, that's the foreman. When the foreman dropped more work on you, he'd always say, have a ball, make a racket. But they're the same as other places, and I gradually progressed up the line to higher and higher technology and found that all the same principles were there of dividing the labor and getting everybody to do the smallest possible little part of the job.
How small would it get down to? What were the individual jobs and tasks at a ping pong factory or a tuna fish packing factory?
Small. For instance, let me read for you a little bit here at the Bumblebee Tuna Fish Plant at Astoria, Oregon.
Okay, fine, from your book.
I'm standing in front here waiting for the people to come out of work, which one of the things about factory work is that you get out when the work is over. You get out when, in this case, when they run out of tuna. And that is coming to be more and more the case in modern offices where you get out of the bank 5 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, whenever you process the day's work. It's much more like assembly line, and you'll fill in with a few temps for certain shifts. So anyhow, I'm waiting out there, and so is this young man is waiting for his girlfriend. Oh, I mean, he was such a cross-eyed, funny-looking guy. I mean, I don't mean to make fun of cross-eyed, but he was really a very creepy character. But finally, the girlfriend comes out. And she said she'd be perfectly happy to tell me about her job. And I say, well, what do you do in the cannery? I clean tuna, she said. The loins come past me on a belt. The loins are the skinned, headless, tailless, halved, or quartered pieces of fish. I bone the loin and take out the dark meat, the cat food. I put the clean loins on the second belt, the cat food on the third belt, and I save out my bones. You're not allowed to dump any garbage till the line lady okays it, because that's how they check your work. They count your bones and see if you're clean. Now, this is a very primitive place, this tuna fish factory, where they literally count the bones. But wherever you go, the job is organized so there's a way to check each person's productivity, whether it be a computer that automatically counts every keystroke and knows to the tenth of a second when you stop to scratch your nose, or I come around and I count the number of bones and there's only so many of that type of bone in each fish. Well, do you talk to the other women, I asked? Not really, she answered. What do you do all day? I daydream. What do you daydream about? About sex. I guess that's my fault, her boyfriend apologized proudly. No, it's not you, she said. It's the tuna fish. I asked quite curiously what she meant. Well, first of all, it's the smell. You got that certain smell in your nose all day. It's not like the smell out here, out there in the yard. It was terrible. Your own fish next to you is sweet. And then there's the men touching you when they punch the tags on your back. Another interesting factor in that place, because instead of your punching in and your pay beginning when you punched in, they come along the line. You wore big aprons and you had the tags hanging down the back of these plastic aprons, so they would punch you in to the nearest tenth of an hour, nearest 6 minutes. They didn't cheat you. They didn't go ahead. They went back to the nearest 6 minutes, but you didn't have any dawdling or meandering time, which, again, up to dating it, you come in, there are many systems where you work on a word processing typewriter, you punch your number in, and the first thing happens is a screen comes on and says, good morning, Sally, you're 3 minutes late. And they may personalize this. I mean, I know one person who went nuts when it said, how is your dog? because someplace in personality decided to personalize each person's screen. So it says, good morning, Sal, you're 3 minutes late. How is your dog this morning? Anyway, be that as it may. Okay, so she's telling about what makes this job so sexy. Well, first it's the smell. You've got that certain smell in your nose all day. It's not like the smell out here. Your own fish next to you is sweet. And then there's the men touching you when they punch the tags on your back. And maybe the other women on the line. But it's mostly handling the loins. Not the touch itself, because we wear gloves, but the soft colors, the reds and the whites and the purples. The most exciting thing is the dark meat. It comes in streaks. It's red-brown, and you have to pull it out with your knife. You pile it next to your loin, and it's crumbly and dark red and moist like earth. You're supposed to put the cat food on the belt as you finish each loin, but I hold it out to make as big a pile of dark meat as I can. Well, this young lady had recently gotten the job. I stayed in the town for about 4 weeks. When I saw her at the end of the time, she had A, broken up with that boyfriend, and B, she had also decided that the dark meat really wasn't as sensuous or interesting as it was. But, she told me, I still save it out to make the pile next to me to see how much I've gotten done in that half hour.
It's like the ping pong paddles. It's like, I guess, anything to be able to have some product.
To have some feeling like you're doing something. And there's such an attack on that, the way work is organized.
Well, do people have to, I guess people do have to go to extreme distances to rationalize or create some type of pride in a job that is might be just the motion of your wrist all day long or just such a minuscule thing?
Right. Look, I was, I remember when I was listening to key punchers talk. And now key punching to me is one of the hardest. At that time, I had not done the worst of office automated jobs. I have now. On video display terminals, it's the worst work I've ever done. But at that time, key punch seemed like the worst work because your feet are more or less got to stay in place. Your eyes are got to stay in a certain place. Your hands are controlled. Your brain is somewhat controlled. I mean, it's hard to daydream when you're accurately copying numbers. But people are something else. People are not to be believed. I talked to somebody and said, well, what do you do to keep from going crazy? Do you have any games you play? And people looked at me like, what do I mean, games? But then one woman said, well, see, the kind of key punching they had over at the telephone company, you were all doing same, you know, the card would come up in your front of your face automatically, and you would key in something that was 3 digits for the city, perhaps, a city code. And then it would move automatically into the next field, and you would key in something that was 6 digits that was the date, and then it would move into the, well, that dates came up automatically each day, but something 6 digits, and then it would move over to something else, and it would be something 9 digits, which would be the amount or the phone number or something. It was all set up for you. You didn't have to touch anything. You didn't have to press key shift or anything, but that would make a certain sound. 3 digits and then click over to the next thing. 6 digits and click over to the next thing. So this woman would say, well, I was trying to keep up exactly in pace with the person next to me so that we would go absolutely together. Buzz, 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 click. Buzz, 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 click. Buzz, 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 click. And I started asking other people about that, and it turned out that many people were working out games with the only thing they had free, which was their ear. And there was one person who was very quiet, but she turned out to be a very complex syncopator who was trying to work it up so it was going buzz, 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 click, buzz, 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 click. So she was moving into one field in the middle of the other person moving up to another field with a third person on the other side going the other way. But as in all these systems, of course, she would say sorrowfully, if somebody made a mistake and had to go on, I just had to go forward. I couldn't wait for her sound, her field, because, of course, again, all of these systems have a built-in way of counting each person's productivity and each person's output.
One of the things that struck me when I was reading your book was that you asked a lot of people, well, what do you do? And a lot of the people couldn't describe it because they just never verbalized it before. And they said, I don't know how to tell about this stuff.
Oh, listen, when I gave all the live long day back to the people who worked in these jobs, they were so thrilled. And when I asked them what they do, they usually did not think I meant what do you do. They would just give the title, grade 3 machine operator or something like that. That I really meant what do you do was very surprising to most people. And I'll tell you, like talking around with these key punchers and or the tuna fish people. You see, that was a young person I started with. That was, I guess I was sort of afraid of talking to, you know, older, hardworking, long, loyal to the company people or whatever. But in that town, for instance, these tuna fish people were all Finnish. And when I started asking other people, it turns out they all had dark meat, white meat, some kind of favorite thing that they were doing. Talking to these key punchers about what kind of game they played, what brought out so many surprises and giggles. It was like talking to women in the park about sex and everybody saying, oh my God, you mean I'm not crazy, you know? So people loved hearing about this because it is what they do 7-8 hours a day.
Did you find that there were many, were there any generational differences between, workers who have been at the place for a long time and younger people, with how they related to management, how they related
not
to the job?
Not on the big thing, which is that people want some meaning in their job. I was surprised by the time I finished this book. When I started, I thought that I would like the young people and I would be interested in the sabotage and the games and the gimmicks. By the time I got finished at places like MetLife Insurance Company, my sympathies ran in the direction of the older people who would sometimes rebel for the purpose of doing a good job, like a lady at MetLife who knew every time a certain call came in that she routed it a certain way and that person was never going to get an answer because she understood the system. She had been there when the system had not been computerized yet. And she finally said, I don't care. I'm not supposed to move, but I've been here 20 years and I'm not going to let this person who's trying to collect the insurance and is very grieved anyway keep going round and round and round. And she got up, which to her was a big rebellion, and walked downstairs to another department and took something and moved it from one file to another so the person would not be in the wrong place when it happened. The younger people that were brought in as the system is more and more mechanized had no way of knowing what it was about. And as a result, well, chicken or egg, it's hard to say. Well, I know what my answer is, but the companies will say, we've done the system this way because we get young people who are more ignorant and more illiterate. But I say it's kind of chicken. Mm-hmm. Or egg, whichever it is. Something's right. Come first. But anyway, at this point, the job is inconceivable that you're even doing insurance files. And when I found young people, for instance, sometimes there were places where they let you off at 4 in the summer if everything was finished, they would take things and just hide them away, throw them away. By the time I finished, I didn't think that was such a wonderful. I felt sorry for the fact that they had so little contact with the fact that this was someone's insurance policy and they were going to lose. It was going to be a great service to someone on the other end trying to get the thing straight, you know. So that I started out with a certain amount of sympathy or thought that I would talk more to young people, mainly because I would be shy to go over to loyal company workers as if I was denigrating their job. But by the end, mostly it was just the same, and the older people had more to tell you about the time when it was something.
Like the lady
who was moved from a typist, a real secretary, over to being a word processor, which, by the way, the machines, a word processing typewriter, I think is terrific. But she was now doing the job steadily all day in a typing pool situation, 125 lines an hour. And the fact that she knew that there were mistakes coming past her was no longer relevant. She had to type it, and then the mistakes would come back on a yellow copy, etc. And she was talking about the young secretaries. And she said, now look at these women around me. It's a good job because you're using this new machine. It pays well right now. And they think they're really secretaries. I mean, they don't know what it was, she said. And then she said, but listen to me complaining like that. Here I'm sounding like an old codger. I'm saying, oh, the snowstorms used to be snowstorms in my day. The jobs used to be jobs in my day. The tomatoes tasted like tomatoes. Maybe I'm just an old lady and I don't remember. And then she says, but tell me the truth. Didn't the tomatoes used to taste different? Well, what we see happening is the tomatoes did taste different. Most of us can't remember a different way of doing industrial work. But right now, clerical office work and by the way, professional work is being transformed in the direction of greater division of labor, simplification, and naturally, you know, for only one purpose. Not because it gets the job done better or even faster, but because it makes everybody cheap, replaceable workers.
Did you see much sabotage? Is that common?
Much less than I expected. You know, the first story I did was at the Lordstown Automobile Assembly Plant. I raced there because I thought I'd watch all that sabotage they were writing about in the papers. Very little compared to the opposite, just trying to make the day more interesting.
Sometimes
you would see people on an assembly line apparently slowing down. And you would think they were going to let the cars get through undoorknobbed. You know, they'd have something that they'd have to do every 30 seconds. And they'd let a few go past and then race to catch up, as if, so to speak, asserting themselves, making their own pace. As you and I work when we have to get a story in and we work a certain bit and then we have to race and get it done, or as you work in your own kitchen because you have a dinner time that's a real deadline, not a crazy 20-second assembly line moving belt function in front of you.
A theme that I detected from a lot of the people that you interviewed was the sense of being treated like kids. I guess that's all wrapped up with, you know, being your work being reduced to...
I mean, you have to treat, you know, you have to treat that secretary well who knows everything about the business. You do. I mean, I know there's a lot of talk about the cup of coffee and the indignity, but it's much more respected position ultimately in most cases than the person that's working on the typing pool, that's put in, that's called from the temp agency, that can be replaced very quickly.
Well, in the sense of being treated like children, did you observe at all, like, I don't know, places that had workplace hassles that clearly weren't related to productivity or performance efficiency, but I don't know, just something there that just sort of helps set a hierarchy of things.
Well,
meaningless
I'm not quite
hassles.
Sure what kind of thing
I don't
you're
know,
talking about.
Dress codes or decorum or anything like that.
It was by the time I wrote this book, of course, all of that was breaking down. Again, everything has to do with the value of the person. On the back offices of these assembly line type insurance companies and so forth, people dress wacky. I mean, it's night shift, day shift, it's factory. Nobody's dressed up in their stockings. They wear funny T-shirts that say horrible things about bosses, companies, whatever they want to say they wear. No one cares, really, because you're just a hand. You don't have to be. Maybe that's the advantage of a back office, is that you're not a part of the company. You're not selling your smile. That's the one advantage. On the other hand, again, much depends on your position of importance. Remember, when I got out of college, computer programmers were real important people. And at ITT and IBM, they could be long-haired kids with boots and things like that. They just had to accept it. And they're not anymore because the job, like these other jobs, the programmers have deprogrammed programming till it's a fairly fill-in-the-blank operation. So therefore, you have to be like what they want you to be.
Were there certain pet peeves that people had that surprised you that you just wouldn't have thought existed about where they work, you know, in an assembly line context or in a high-tech context?
Things that I didn't expect?
Yeah.
Well, I...
Or what came up?
For instance, these may sound very minor, but I've done a lot of work on video display terminals. It's terrible. And you would think that you'd like the machine to break down so that you could rest. And people do, a real breakdown. Everybody loves a real breakdown. But when the machines are slow, response time, you get the problem that you have to keep picking your neck up and down to see what's happening. And so if the machine slows down and you can't just... In other words, more people than I thought wanted to be mesmerized. They say, if it keeps going at the same pace, I can be hypnotized. If I don't have to look up, if everything goes exactly equal, I can look up and, oh, it's 10 minutes later instead of being a half a minute later. So people don't want the machine to have erratic response time that requires them to pick their head up and down. Of course, I must tell you that video display terminal work, when you're doing straight clerical work on it, as opposed to an editor or typing your own work as a reporter, turns out, according to the last year NIOSH study, to have the highest rate of stress diseases of any occupation they ever studied, including air traffic controllers.
Why? Because of the extreme regularity and...
It is, you know, these games I told you about on other things. Well, they have got it. It is the assembly line to its nth. I mean, it's assembly line in that things drop in front of you rather than you know, you don't press the key punch and you don't press the return carriage anymore.
The cursor, right.
Right, the cursor moves by itself to the next...
Well, how does this approach to work affect people?
And you have to work it very hard. And plus, there's the eye strain and the product, the actual health problems of the machine.
How does this type of workplace affect the people who are a little higher up, the middle management people?
Oh, if it may cheer you up to know, since most of us do the bottom work, that a great effort is going in now to doing the same kind of tailorizing, routinizing of higher-up professional and middle management work. So that, for instance, in an enormous brokerage firm where I worked, where people were selling millions of dollars worth of insurance because they sold insurance to corporations, not to individuals, the guys had to punch in onto a machine, onto their management information systems, according to a series of 300 codes, what they had done every half hour. So that management had gone to the trouble of creating a study that described all so-called high management thinking work, such as S22 would be phoned back to corroborate price after conference. S27 would be prepare an estimate, and so on. And they had gone to the trouble to demystify this work. So it isn't, I made the big sale today and I know how and you don't, but rather I did so many S22s. And they also bothered to collect the telephone numbers of all the contacts and the people that people saw. And of course, you know what that does to a salesman. I mean, what's a salesman's his mystique in life is the contacts he knows and others don't, and this, Willie Loman, the secretary who he brought flowers to, etc. Take that away and file it in a central file, which they did in this place. Everybody's contacts, everybody's lists of phone backs, including the numbers, the telephone numbers of,
In the end, does it work? I mean, for improved efficiency and for whatever...
Depends what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
When you phone the phone company and the lady is working essentially on what's called computer-aided interview techniques, and she says, is this a business or a residential? And you say, well, I don't know. My grandfather put the telephone in, and I'm sorry, is this a business or a residential? And she can't deviate from that because she has a screen in front of her, and if she presses A, business, one set of questions generates, and if she presses B, then another set of questions generates. By the way, the machine has very little to do with this because, that's what you did on a piece of paper before you had the machine. Nonetheless, is it more efficient or is it less efficient? Well, it's terrible for the public. It's terrible for the worker. Obviously, the company feels a lot more secure with somebody that they don't have to count on for anything but to go by the series of questions. The fact that they are eliminating the need for human common sense and experience and intuition is very, they love it. They consider that to give them a more reliable, cheaper, better worker. Is it good? I mean, you have to answer that question. And whether it's even faster, I don't know. Typing pool is not faster than a fast typist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Scanners at the supermarket are not faster than keying it up.
A moment ago, you were talking about the strain associated with working at a video display terminal.
Oh, it's the worst job I ever did. My neck hurt, other people's eyes hurt, other people's backs hurt, and you just considered a room of hysterical women.
How are unions? Is there any type of organizing? Are there work issues that can meet that stuff?
Listen, this is a lot of what I'm going to talk about at the Wooden Shoe at the anarchist meeting tonight, because we sure have to come up with different tactics.
Well, what are the issues that you think should be important?
Well,
at this
the
point?
Issues. The first of all, the unions don't handle them at all. When they do, if they have good rank and file people who know that it simply hurts them to walk into that place, that windowless room, then they manage to get on paper in very few places what's called the ergonomics, meaning that's a fancy word for kind of work study, but it's very peripheral. It means a screen with less glare, the right kind of chair. The keyboard that detaches from the screen so that you can work in a slightly different position so that people of varied sizes aren't compelled to hold their hands in funny ways. And I'm not saying that that's unimportant. But this is the level at which the best, and there are very few of them, contracts, in fact, I only know of one, have been able to get contracts to deal with that issue. But then the fact that the job has been designed so that you sit there in front of the screen and do the same thing over and over and over and over, and deliberately designed, by the way, to reduce it to numerical so you can't even in your wildest imagination figure out what this thing is that you're working on. What is it codes for? That aspect of it has not been addressed either by a union or by any rank and file action. And, of course, the one place I know, which is Blue Shield of California, where they won these work conditions for VDTs, what they did right afterwards was simply to move all the VDT work, the bulk of it, the Medicaid work, all around the state, because you're talking about an operation that doesn't have to be located in any physical place. That's the advantage, and it is a true advantage, of the new electronic technology, is the instantaneous communication.
Well, do you see any...
So then, that's why I want to talk about that at the Anarchist Bookstore tonight. The tactics have to be different. These Blue Shield people in California picketed for 4 months to win certain guards against the worst health hazards in their contract, and then the jobs were moved away. We have to approach it differently. We have to start figuring out that only the information on those screens are valuable to the management. So how do we make that information ours? How do we hold that up, you know, as part of our strike?
Do you find issues of alienation in jobs which are sort of higher up on the scale?
In terms of
who having control over your own job and your own life, like a doctor or lawyer?
Listen, what they did with social workers in Boston and Seattle, maybe other cities, but these cities had violent results that I know of. Again, the social worker already is so far away from whatever they studied in school about helping people. These are intake people at welfare centers, and they have a questionnaire they have to ask. Well, they had people sitting next to them, the old Taylorist time stop people, figuring out how many seconds it should take to get the name address part of the information, how many seconds it should get the family data information, and they had codified it so the interview took just a certain amount of seconds for every part of the interview. The result in those two cities that I know about was physical attacks on social workers who were pushing people through the pace of this particular intake interview, and who, of course, were themselves pushed through the pace. In Boston, I believe there was enough of an advanced welfare rights organization so that the worker and the recipients got together to fight this. In Seattle, I don't think that happened. Now, these are supposed to be professionals, right? Social workers, whatever. And here they are doing a clerical job and now being time studied on the clericalness of the job. More and more emphasis, as we know, is put on the idea that a doctor can do his diagnosis by machine. I don't have time to go on here. I'd love to tell you about Doctor, the program invented at MIT to do psychoanalysis.
We have about a minute. Okay, then let me ask you.
I'll tell you tonight at the Wooden Shoe Bookstore. Let me ask you real briefly.
Do you have anything that you're planning to go undercover for? Any other workplaces that you're planning to visit?
I'm writing now about high-tech jobs, the ones we talked about just a little bit. And listen, I don't have to go undercover. You know, with the replaceability of the worker, you go down to office temps, you get the job, they send you out. They don't care who you are anyway.
Well, thanks very much for being here, Barbara. And I've been speaking with Barbara Garson. She is in Philadelphia to speak tonight at the Wooden Shoe in a lecture series, and that's going to be held at the Community Education Center at 3500 Lancaster Avenue. And I'll give you a phone number for that in just a moment. Barbara is also the author of All the Livelong Day, The Meaning and Demeaning of Routine Work, which is published by Penguin. Now, if you want to hear Barbara...
It's only $2.95.
Okay, we shouldn't mention prices.
We can't? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so happy that I had a cheap book.